one of the first places I discovered the work of our host, our guest today, Mike Hoffman, was online. I think it was in the late 90s. I was asking Mike when he first started writing, and he had been on the Well back in the early 90s. But I think I read the summary of his core work on at Principia Cybernetica in the late 90s, or maybe it wasn't until he founded EgoDeath.com in 2001. But in any case, Mike's thoughts are one of those zones that I would sort of occasionally encounter on the internet, where you'd come across like a full-born theory, which we'll be getting into today on ego death, or the cybernetic theory of ego transcendence, a kind of mixture of cybernetics, psychology, religious history, entheogenic philosophy. And it just grabbed me. Like, right off the bat, there was something peculiar and extremely stimulating about this thought, the way that it deals with determinism and control and our own possibility of experiencing different relationships with these issues. And I'm not really sure why. I've always been kind of obsessed with, or sort of haunted almost by the idea of things being absolutely determined, or the experience of, say, time loops, as if you're repeating the same thing over and over again. I'd have these in dreams. I'd have these in other kinds of altered states experiences. And I've also been haunted by the idea that we simply repeat our lives ad infinitum until we find some way of transcending the loop, something that, you know, I think I probably first discovered reading Nietzsche and really thinking about the eternal return. You know, people, you know, Nietzsche gets a lot of props by ordinary, you know, academic philosophers, and some of them write about the eternal return, but a lot of people kind of write it off as a little, like a goofy myth and not so important. But for me, that was always key. It seemed like if you were going to take Nietzsche on, you really had to come up with the eternal return. That's a little... that's different than Mike's theory, but for me, it's all kind of it all resonates in powerful and interesting ways. And I raise the specter of the academic philosopher partly to distinguish what I like about thinkers like Mike, who has been working since the 1980s on developing his theory, and he's read widely, and you can see his, you know, the books that he's drawing from, both in his writings and in his, you know, the bibliographies that are at his egodeath.com website and other places. But he's also a singular thinker. He's trying to build his own system and use that system to explain other philosophical, mythic, and religious ideas, particularly ideas in Greek mythology and in early Christianity, in the mystery religions. And so it's a very satisfying, it's always been a very satisfying experiment, if you will, for me. And I kind of like the idea of that even as academic philosophers worry about what philosophy is and whether it serves any purpose anymore, I just read a New York Times article a couple of weeks ago that was lamenting the sort of professionalization and sort of insularity of philosophy today. It's always reminded me that there are people who are more on the outside who are working to build their theories, and even if they don't get it all right, who can ever get it all right? There's a lot of really stimulating ideas out there. So anyway, I was very happy when out of the blue, Mike wrote me an email and said he wanted, you know, was thinking about how much fun it would be to be on Expanding Minds. So here we are. So Mike, thanks so much for joining the show.
Yeah, thanks a lot. I think the theory is really tight, compact, tiny, has massive explanatory power at this point in time, and I've gotten really good at summarizing it.
Well, that's great. Well, you know what? There's two ways we could do it. One, you could just kind of lay down your nice summary that, as you say, you've been working on this and you've been honing it over a long period of time. But I'm also really interested in a little bit about how you kind of came to it. So whichever way is easier way to tell the story, take your pick. But so go for it.
Yeah, well, the center point of the origin of the theory was I was trying to debug our poor self-control. So starting in like the early 80s, I'd been spending a lot of time with my father, who has a background in counseling and transpersonal psychology, humanistic psychology. And so he had me go to all the encounter groups and learn all of Ken Wilber and Alan Watts and Maslow. What I was taught in those seminars was you control your mind. You control your thinking and you take responsibility for it. And so I tried to make good on that and thought, wow, what a wonderful vision if we could have non-dysfunctional self-control and have, and so, but I realized that everyone had buggy self-control, and these seminars existed to help people get rid of their errors in their self-control thinking. So I thought I was very well positioned, like in Extropian fashion. I had the latest technology. I was an electrical engineering undergraduate student, and the whole community was supporting me because I was identified as gifted, grew up with several families, got a lot of different influences, very diverse around the San Francisco area. And so I thought, hey, I'm better positioned than anyone else to debug this problem of that the human operating system has dysfunctional self-control. And I thought that around 1986, I thought, well, towards that, I'll spend a couple of weeks figuring out what enlightenment is about and ego transcendence and put that into clear rational thinking. That actually took me about 2 years and 2 months. And I didn't have time to do that, so it was really stressful. I was trying to do my engineering homework and math at the same time. Then I had the breakthrough in 1988 where I realized, wow, you know, you can explain Alan Watts' book, Way of Zen, or his article, Zen and the Problem of Control. You can explain that if you took what I learned from physics class, Minkowski space-time diagrams with the frozen single future. Minkowski lectured on that in 1907 and published in 1908. 1908 was also the year of McTaggart's article on the A series versus the B series of time. So I applied those ideas from 1908, the block universe model of time and control where there's a single frozen future. And I thought, wow, you know, this would kill ego way more strongly than the conventional stuff in the Journal of Transpersonal Psychology, which has you meditate and experience non-duality. I thought, you know, we can do a lot more intense than experiencing non-duality. We can experience a certain lack of control, a certain non-control, and also this block universe model implies there's only a single frozen future that already exists, and you're helplessly tied to a rail so that everything like Odysseus or like Oedipus, as you try to steer along into your future, you end up steering as you were made to steer, following this rail. And I realized, wow, this model that I got from physics, the Minkowski space-time diagram in the block universe, this really kills ego power way more intensely than anything I'm reading in the Journal of Transpersonal Psychology.
You know, I just want to interrupt and just to make one little point to clarify for listeners who might not have heard of the Minkowski space-time block is that this is a key idea or outcome from Einstein's work on relativity, so that when Einstein creates the link between space and time as being part of a single field, that space, you know, when you describe space-time, one way of describing, one very good way of describing that physics is fairly happy with within the standard model is as this sort of space-time block. You know, so people think that relativity means, oh, everything's relative. Well, yes, in one light, but in another light, you can talk about Einstein in terms of this space-time block. So it's a very central idea in physics.
Yeah, I think I'll point out that Parmenides, the pre-Socratic Greek philosopher Parmenides, was in the altered state and had a vision of the essentially the same block universe. idea. And so the philosopher of science, Karl Popper, when he corresponded with Einstein, he referred to Einstein as Parmenides. So this idea of the block universe revealed in the altered state goes back to the pre-Socratics.
And so for you, you could see the way that if you could not just think about this model, this possibility that everything that seems to lie open in the future is actually a rail that's already set in stone, so to speak, that if one could actually experience that, that experience itself would be a more radical ego transcender than the typical routes that were around the self-help community and self-development worlds over the last couple of decades. So how did you go forward with that, and what happened in 1988?
In 1987, I was on an engineering co-op, and I worked during the day and using early personal computers at work, typed up some of these ideas, and then at night I would handwrite in my binder. So I did 7 months of solid idea development. That's all I did, aside from the 40 hours of work. And I ramped up to, I estimated periodically, okay, what percentage complete am I towards rationally figuring out what ego transcendence is really all about? And then I got back to campus for the spring semester, and I was in the computer lab on a early Mac, like a Mac Classic, in January 88. And I was typing up my idea development files as always in this IV covered computer lab. And I had been working, like, during December 87, I had been reading Alan Watts' Way of Zen like 5 or 6 times, really, really trying to say, okay, how can I make rational sense out of this? What's he really getting at here? And so it all came together then in like January 11th, 1988, in the computer lab, where I was like, oh, the block universe from physics. I was starting to take another physics class that semester. This fits, this enables me to make sense out of what Alan Watts wrote about Zen, Satori, and control, personal control. So I just really brought together those ideas. They came slamming together, and I was like, this completely explains it. And so that made life a lot easier for me, because I wasn't struggling for self-control in a way that didn't make sense anymore. I was like, oh, now if the future is preset, that kind of changes everything. And so then I was like, you know, I'm going to withdraw from engineering and go get a degree in philosophy or religion or psychology. But I looked into those fields. I thought, nah, these are not happening. The engineering coursework did good for me. It enabled me to think clearly. So I stayed with that.
Well, you know, let's just stop with that. I think that's also really, really, really interesting, and it comes through in your work. You know, in some ways, because you've avoided the more conventional psychology, religion, that whole those worlds. I mean, you draw from them, but you've kind of remained in some ways an engineer thinking about these metaphysical and religious issues. And there's something very very powerful and very interesting about that. And I think it's really important to emphasize your relationship to Alan Watts, because, you know, from even if you can actually read Watts fairly deeply and not recognize the incredible important role that cybernetics plays in his thought. He doesn't talk about it that often. He talks about it here and there. It's in The Way of Zen. It's in some of his first, or his books in the 50s. And it comes up in that essay about control. But once you see it, once you see that he's very aware of cybernetic discourse that's emerging from, you know, World War II and the Macy conferences in the early 1950s, as people realize that we can talk about systems of control as a way to describe both human learning and the way that plants operate and the way that ecosystems operate, that systems theory or cybernetics gives us a language of these larger control patterns and learning patterns, that Watts totally got that. He totally saw that, and he totally saw how particularly Zen and, you know, Buddhist ways of thinking about the self and no self and things were overlaid this model very clearly. And once you see that link in him, you can see it throughout his work. And I think that you, being an engineer and doing all this work and working with reason and not being as interested in the sort of exoticism maybe of Zen or whatever, that enabled you to see that and bring it forward much more clearly and with, you know, very interesting results. And so I wanted to ask you, it was just kind of a sidelight. What I wanted to ask you a little bit was, as you were coming up with these ideas, and you mentioned like no longer struggling with your own sense of your own faulty sense of self-control, how this sort of unfolded in terms of the way that you experienced your ordinary day, where you have to make decisions or apparently have to make decisions and things like that, as you sort of played with the consequences of your expanding idea of control.
Yes, I talked then. I wrote about during 1988, during the fallout of this realization, when I starting to draft my original drafts of my article, which took decades to write. I was still continuing to wrestle or struggle with personal control, like of my coursework. Mostly it was coursework at that time. Society helped me take care of paying bills, and so I was just mostly trying to coordinate my responsibilities. And you know, I was always trying to get straight A's, but in practice, well, I still spent a lot of time in 88 doing electric guitar research on guitar amp tone, which took also a lot of my time. And a lot of my time struggle was struggling between my research and electric guitar tube amp processing, as opposed to doing my proper assigned coursework, which was mostly math in my classes. So I used the idea of the virtual ego, and that we still have to, given that we're normally in the ordinary state of consciousness, and which inherently uses the egoic thinking and the sense of being in control or moving through time, I still had to do practical control. So I used the ideas like practical control versus sort of theoretical non-control. The practical approach still reigned large. I couldn't deny it. Here I have homework due. You know, there's this reality: homework due, assignments, exams coming up. Clearly, I had to practically get my head together and manage my time schedule and do my best to make plans and then follow through consistently on those plans of time management. So I called that practical control.
Yeah, that makes sense. You know, this reminds me of Susan Blackmore, who wrote I think it's called The Meme Machine, where she really takes Richard Dawkins' ideas about memes really seriously. And so from a different angle, it comes to similar kinds of conclusions about the illusion of believing that we're really in control or making decisions. And she has this great description, and she also is a Zen practitioner. So she's got that kind of secular Zen naturalist kind of impulse, doesn't go as far into religion as you, but she had this one line one practice that she had that was very interesting, where she would be like, if you're facing a trivial decision, like you're driving home and you're coming to a place where there's you can go two different ways, and you know, sometimes you go one way, sometimes you go the other, why, who knows, but like you're coming up at the decision, and instead of quote unquote making the decision, you don't make the decision, and you witness as you or your body or whatever you want to call it makes the decision. So you like actively don't decide until the moment that you have to open your mouth or you have to actually move the wheel one way or the other. And I've done that. It's very interesting. It's very interesting. It's because you realize in a very simple way how much the decisions we seem to make are really a story we're telling ourselves about what our bodies are doing. but I wanted to go a little bit farther with you, because you put this experience of non-control or of determinism not just in a physics sense or a no free will philosophical sense, but in a religious, bigger sense, a more of a one that reframes what we mean by sacred experience. So I'd like to hear about that. How do you see, maybe looking at Greek myth or whatever, or your own experience, or the kinds of experiences that people have with entheogens or with salvia divinorum, as I know something that you've talked about, and since it's a legal plant, we can talk about it, that how it is that people can actually have experienced this deterministic universe, Parmenides and the mystics, etc., and what kind of religious or sacred outcome or what kind of signs we see from that that encounter, which is obviously very harrowing in some ways.
The harrowing part is the fun part, the pathway that leads through to the transformation of our thinking about control and possibility and time. People refer to that these days as the shadow, and it's described in mythology, which is analogy. Mythology is analogy for altered state realizations. And it's this this so-called shadow is the sort of mixed feelings about retaining the sense of personal control in the altered state. It turns out that we really want to explore and test our personal control power in the altered state. It's appealing and attractive to do that. Now, my style of thinking is based firmly in non-metaphorical thinking, so non-mythological thinking. So it's important to explain, you have to be able to explain everything in direct terms appropriate for scientific rationality, and then map those terms through a kind of decoding, encoding, or translation, translate those ideas into religious mythology, which is analogy describing the altered state realization. That altered state realization is specifically transforming thinking from the possibilism mental model to the eternalism mental model. So it's very binary. You switch from one way of thinking, one specific way of thinking, to another specific way of thinking.
And possibilism, that's the conventional cognitive situation where we're like, oh, there's this possibility, there's that possibility. The world, the future is open possibilities. And eternalism is that there's already a space-time block that's set.
Yes. So in terms of quantum physics, which there's a lot of interest in, I consider multi-worlds or many worlds and the multiverse as being low thinking, ordinary state-based thinking, which is possibilism. It's the idea of branching. Now, if there's a many worlds, how do I steer among the many worlds? Well, it's ego power. I use my ego power to steer among the branching many worlds. So I consider the multiverse and many worlds to be a form of low thinking or initial thinking or egoic thinking. Whereas high thinking, I associate with Einstein's block universe where there's a single preset future. If the ego has no power and is nothing but an epiphenomenal illusion cast forth by the brain and it has no real power, well, then there's only a single future. I'm just passively brought into one, whatever one single future there is. I don't have any power to steer among a multiverse. And the metaphors there are switching from tree thinking to snake thinking. Initially, in the ordinary state, we think in terms of steering among a branching open future possibility branching tree. But in the altered state, a different way of thinking is revealed where we see our future path of thoughts as a snake-shaped rail that's frozen into a single future. So this kind of accommodates both ways of thinking. You end up with both ways of thinking. 99.9% of the time, you're going to be in the ordinary state of consciousness and rely on egoic possibilism, possibility branching thinking. Although the veil has been pulled back, to use a metaphor, in the altered state, the veil is temporarily pulled back to reveal that your thoughts are forced upon you from an invisible source that you have to put your trust in.
Yeah, I have to say, when you say that, you know, I'm recalling that the, you know, the most profound altered, I don't know, like calling it altered state, I don't like calling it a mystical experience, whatever it was that happened on the Natch, no compounds in the picture. When I was at a Zen retreat of all places, and I've written about this in Nomad Codes, there's a description of this experience that's more elaborate than what I'll say now. But the one of the biggest takeaways, one of the real cognitive insights that was at the time, of course, it was completely obvious that, you know, that reality was just a series of causes and conditions that were setting things in motion, and that there was some kind of mental or presence of awareness that was mixed up in this, and that we suffer because we think we can change the flow and push and pull and move, and that all of the suffering is derived from that attempt to manipulate this kind of process of causes and conditions, which is very resonant with what you're talking about. And what you do, and one of the nice things about your work that makes it rich, is that you find this basic binary switch and some of its consequences reflected in so much religion and mysticism, particularly Greek mythology and Christianity and Gnosticism. And so there's these nice layers. You're not just providing this kind of engineering blueprint of a process of how control could work at these different stages, but also showing how it kind of manifests in these different levels. And one of those manifestations is the kind of moment where you give yourself over, where you realize you're not in control. There's some larger force. So it's not just that you see in your view, it's not just that you realize that we're inside a completely determined universe and there's no hope that you're going to change your future, which could be a very depressing mechanical, you know, we're ruled by the lower gods, the archons of the astrological forces have got us in their pockets. There's nothing we can do. We're stuck in the matrix, blah, blah, blah. But there's another move that you make, a move that has to do with surrender to a transcendent, but another level of control or agency that's moving through the picture. Talk about that shift a little bit from this vision of a determinist model where we're locked in, we're fated to follow our snake-like train track into the future, towards the kind of the openness that comes with that, that can come after going through that sort of darker or more claustrophobic vision.
The release when you surrender, such as trembling prayer and officially mentally saying, "Oh, I get it now. My thinking has been contaminated with free will thinking still, and finally I've reached this consistent point where I realize, wow, I really am helplessly dependent on this pre-given rail of my control thoughts." Now when you come to that position, that stance of accepting that this is the only configuration that coheres and is going, the only way you're going to reach stability is to accept this reality that's revealed. And so when you then do this surrender or sacrifice of free will thinking, then stability is restored, and then it feels, you know, that pressure has gone away and the threat then suddenly vanishes. And that can be described in religious mythology, which is analogy, that can be described or marketed as a new freedom, freedom from this or that. You know, language is so incredibly flexible. That's one thing I've learned. And, you can really get lost in all the possibilities. You wrote in your new edition of Technosis about the sort of the history of thinking about determinism, which I'd call better eternalism. Maybe around 150 AD, people thought in terms of the Enlightenment as realizing that you can't control your future. So determinism is Enlightenment. And then maybe a little later, with Neoplatonism, there was more of an emphasis on this kind of super transcendent freedom. But now in this postmodern era, we may be remembering now and experiencing in the altered state this idea of the frozen, unchangeable future, and that we can maybe use that, you pointed out, use that to repair the earth.
Yeah.
You
know, it's funny, one of the things that's behind it, and I know you've mentioned this on occasion, but it would be, I think it might be surprising to some listeners, is to recognize how there's an element of good old school Orthodox Christianity in this conversation, you know, not the whole kit and caboodle. But I remain very impressed by Augustine's basic argument about the will. And Augustine's basic argument about the will, which goes into so much of what people dislike about Christianity. I mean, it's not a defense of how Christianity uses this idea, et cetera, but it is still, for me, very important to acknowledge that I am compelled by Augustine's basic riff, which is that human will, that there's no way we can do it on our own because the will itself is already broken. Like, we come into the picture and the will itself is already broken. We're already, that's what inheriting, you know, Adam's sin is about. Is not that we have desires or we're tempted by evil things. That's not the point. The point is that the willer is broken and cannot do it on its own. And there has to be this kind of thing. We see it in AA, you know, the same thing. The AA structures a release of personal will within the context of a kind of hierarchy of values within which there's an overarching framework. And of course, the mystery traditions we don't know that much about them, but they seem to point to similar kinds of renunciations that then get this sort of, additional bonus of some kind of grace that comes through on the other side. But it's very scary, of course, because maybe the grace isn't there. Maybe all we're seeing is our, you know, kind of robotic, futures. Can you talk about maybe experiences you've had, or not experiences, but just the way that you've discovered the kind of release or transcendence that is in this vision that can otherwise seem very, you know, challenging.
This is attractive, this strange attractor control vortex. We go into the altered state saying, I'm determined to hang on to my control. Well, but then as thinking shifts and loosens up, then it's natural to say, well, to retain control, I'm going to need to test control, to test whether it's vulnerable. So now I desire to test, I desire to find a way, to hunt for a way to undermine my control power. And so now we have the mind working against itself. Like when you have a development team, you have a programmer and you have a separate tester, and the tester's job is to make the programmer's code fail. And so the thinking goes into that. And so there's this trembling, exciting, ecstatic defeat of one's own control. And it's something that we are attracted to, like Medusa with her head of snakes, which are worldline snakes representing the block universe. Medusa's head, her snakes are attractive. Same with the sirens, bird women singing their songs that attract the steersman sailors to their death crashing on the rocks. These sailors or steersmen are attracted to the siren song. So I emphasize that this undermining of control is something that the mind actually desires to do, to explore control. And so I'm trying to show cognitive scientists how they can explore this so-called shadow dynamics, which is actually highly appealing. And so there's a strange, like, psychotic mix of excitement at the same time as you explore how you can undermine conventional personal control thinking. And it breaks through then to a new coherent stability. So we move from the initial stability of egoic self-control thinking, where I depend on myself as an ego to steer myself, and I'm stable that way, more or less. But then eventually you reach a new kind of stability where you depend helplessly on these preset thoughts that are given to you.
Yeah, it's amazing stuff. And one of the things is, because you have that interest in the experience of this, so you're saying this isn't just an intellectual model. In fact, this intellectual model helps shape experiences that if you are going in that direction, you may have these kinds of experiences of the lack of control and then the kind of revelation or the ecstasy of that transformation. And it really also gives you a very interesting gives one a very interesting angle on one component of psychedelic experience. So, you know, on the one hand, people talk a lot about psychedelics and transformation and, you know, even ego death in the sense that Leary talked about it. And then, you know, you see beyond the ego and da, da, da. And so we have these kind of stock ways of talking about the transformative potential of psychedelics. But to my mind, they're often they don't often go very far. But you really present like a model of what's happening that could help explain, I think, a lot of people's experiences. Because I think if you look at people's descriptions of their experiences, both positive and negative, that they often revolve around this issue of like realizing that the one you thought in control was in control wasn't in control, or visions of a repetitive universe, or visions of being locked into the same loop over and over again. And there's these sort of intimations of these issues that you talk about inside the experience. And it seems that what you're offering is that rather than just thinking about it conceptually, that you can experientially sort of grab the bull by the horn, so to speak, and have this kind of transformative shift that presumably shapes the 99% of the time that you're in, you know, ordinary thinking as well. And I wanted to ask you that, like, now as you go through your day and you're mostly in your ordinary state of mind and you're making decisions and blah blah blah, what's different? What's changed about the way that you are in the world because of this thinking you've done and these experiences that you've had that has led to your thinking?
Well, communally, as researchers across 100 different fields, it's too early to say. But what it seems to be so far is that this enlightenment offers, well, now I have two different, distinct, contrasting mental models, two mental models, and they contrast. It's a pair of specific mental models about possibility and control. And so, you know, one Zen idea is, well, after enlightenment, nothing's changed. You still do the laundry. And I think that having these two mental models available to the intellect it releases a certain kind of frustration. So I'd say that my personal self-control power is no more coherent. Well, maybe in one way it's a little more coherent than it used to be. There's a certain kind of frustration that is gone. And so now I have just the more plain, usual daily challenges of personal control. But at least I'm not trying to control myself in a way that is frankly self-contradictory, like egoic thinking is.
Right.
I don't make promises beyond that. Like we see in around 150 AD in Mediterranean antiquity in the Roman Empire, we see lots of people doing lots of bad stuff, even though the culture generally was thoroughly saturated with mushroom wine altered state at all these banquets, and religion was thoroughly based on a mushroom altered state, and yet lots of bad things happened. So as far as panacea, that's magical thinking or maybe exoticism. So I'm trying to do this kind of reductionist attitude of enlightenment is merely nothing but gaining this other distinct mental world model. What benefits that brings, well, who knows? You still have to exert energy when you go to the gym to work out. The weights don't just lift themselves.
Yeah, you know, last week we were talking to Stephen Batchelor, I don't know if you listened to the yes. interview or are familiar with the stuff, but you know, he goes in, especially in his books, but this recent one in particular, he talks about how, you know, you can really imagine in a very grounded way a kind of enlightenment model where you recognize, you know, he's not talking about the issues the way you are, but he's talking, you know, it resonates about how you just recognizing the causes and the conditionality of our experience, that every experience we have, every thought, every impulse, we can see within the context of those forces and processes that led to that. So we are aware that we're completely conditional, completely contingent, which, while it's not about determinism, in a way is a different version of a similar kind of recognition that we're not in control, and that enlightenment can be seen really as recognizing this and thereby releasing the kinds of anxieties or illusions that stand in the way of that recognition. But then he makes the point, but yeah, it's not like you're not going to suffer. You know, it's not like you're not going to still have issues that come up and all these kinds of things. So in a way, I think that's part of the something that we're involved in kind of moving beyond. And, you know, maybe we're wrong, but we're moving beyond in our generation or this time is the kind of absolutist model of enlightenment that was so big in the counterculture and the first wave of of lots of people exploring Asian religion and meditation. And there was such this big idea, enlightenment, once you're done and then you're free and you're clean and whatever. And maybe that is true, or true for some people. But it sounds to me like from a lot of people that these experiences, whether or not we call them enlightenment, which is another word that gets in the way and probably is less helpful than other words, that there are these states that of release that nonetheless, you know, there you are, you're still like, ah, do I, you know, am I going to buy that pint of ice cream? I don't know. You know, it's kind of funny because it brings back the ordinary human in a way that sort of, there's something kind of sweet almost about the fact that we can't get away from some of this stuff. We don't become like robots of perfection or anything.
Yeah, we end up with two instead of one mental model. We end up with two, so we end up with a new available set of mental connections. We still have our initial workaday model too. That is relevant. Bad things happen, come up randomly, and regardless of what mental connections you have, you know, you can try to control your thinking and have an enlightened, positive attitude about this stuff. But it still sucks when something bad happens. You still have to deal with it. you can try to think your way out of frustration, but it's when bad things happen and impediments get in your way in daily life, it's still an impediment, and it still feels like an impediment that you can't just think it away.
So I want to ask you another question, which is, so you've been, you know, putting this stuff out there for a long time, and you've stuck with it, and you've refined it, and over time you've gotten more and more readers and fans and people who follow your Yahoo account, and you know, I'm kind of curious about that. Like, what's it like being an independent, you know, system builder, metaphysician? No offense is meaning, but I call it kind of like garage philosophy in the garage band sense, where you're like not in the official zones of metaphysics. You're doing it on your own in a way. And then you're developing people who resonate with it and who kind of deal with you. What's that been like, you know, being this kind of, you know, whatever, underground or online metaphysician, especially as people turn onto it and you develop these relationships and how's that been?
Well, it's a sense of leadership and responsibility and a kind of standing apart as a matter of principle, not really participating too much in pop culture. I tried messing around with a Mono 2000 crew, and then like when Are You Serious said, well, we don't cover LSD because it's not in fashion now, and I kind of ditched him at that point. So I have always felt separate and kind of privileged, because I have grown up in privileged circumstances, and I felt a strong responsibility and was sort of told as much that I have a responsibility to give back to society. And so I succeeded at, I was given all this transpersonal psychology training, a brain dump by my father from the late 70s to the mid 80s. So, I knew I was, in fact, sitting in a different situation than other people, in a more privileged kind of set apart role. And so that's kind of natural to me. And I've felt perfectly successful just going it on my own. And so I'm just dedicated to providing the clearest, most useful model for cognitive scientists so they can go in deeper and explore this. And the funniest idea is to try to imagine a cognitive scientist who's not interested in the altered state. That's an impossibility. So we have such censorship going on now, to get into conspiracy. There's censorship. You can't openly write your thesis as a grad student on these kinds of things. And so what's allowed to be published is only sort of disparagements of the altered state. Those are encouraged to be published. But people who have a positive attitude about these things and they have to suppress the fact that they're interested. But then you can picture, like at a cognitive science conference, a session on altered states gets bombarded with participants because they're not being monitored and they're free to go attend this. And it's clear then that any cognitive scientist, of course, is interested in the altered state.
No, you're totally right on here, and we're at a real turning point in this regard. In that Part of it has to do with the fact that people like us have been working on these things kind of on the outside in our different ways, where maybe we, you know, we kind of parallel some of the developments within the academy. But the academy, as you say, most people can't do this. I mean, even if you, even today with the sort of renaissance of psychedelic research, if you're a young researcher working on your PhD, very few advisors will not only will they sort of suggest that you not work on it, they'll demand it. They'll refuse to accept those kinds of projects. And that's true in cognitive science. It's true in religious studies. You know, it's across the board. But I really believe that that is going to change, is already changing.
All 100 fields that are related all need to thoroughly take on, explicitly take on the altered state, which I call loose cognitive association binding. This because you can't just change, you can't make a significant change in one or two of these fields without thoroughly changing all 100 of them. Fields like mythology, free will and determinism, reformed theology, religion, Christianity, Christian history, Gnosticism. You really have to apply. And Hanegraaff has come out saying that we need to start paying attention, maybe not to the history. He's not quite ready to tackle the historical, like ancient history of entheogens, but he's starting to say, look, the fact is everybody's having these esoteric mystical experiences these days, and that is the subject material that we historians have to study. There's no excuse for avoiding it. And so we need to have high science, high cognitive science, high religion, where finally we can reconcile this battle between science and religion by uniting high science with high religion, high Christianity, and recovering our entheogen-based Christianity and Mediterranean antiquity especially.
Yeah, that's a real important point, is that even though if you think about the history of altered states and religion in terms of the last 50 years, you know, most of the important contacts have been really with Asian religions, with Buddhism, through Watts, with the Tibetan Book of the Dead, with, you know, higher states and all the descriptions of higher states within Hinduism and the visions of the gods and the, you know, many forms of Krishna and Shiva and all that kind of stuff. That's been a lot more of a connection. But in a way, the more interesting push is in the West. I think it's more radical at this point in a way, especially around Christianity and Gnosticism and what was happening in that, you know, era of antiquity. Of course, it's a very ambitious, operation to bring all these things together. But I'm curious, are you frustrated, but that, you know, because you have your work exists where it does, you're providing these tools or these ideas for cognitive science and psychology of religion and all these other kinds of folks. Do you feel like you're being heard? Have you made some connections? Do you have people who are listening to you who aren't just other, you know, fringe characters like me and other people, you know what I mean?
At this point, censorship looms large, sort of back to the conspiracy thinking. For everyone who posts a disagreement with these kinds of ideas like entheogens, for everyone who posts something negative about entheogens, there are silently, we have to assume that there's silently 1,000 scholars and researchers who like the ideas and who want to work with them, but talk about frustration. They are frustrated. I'm able to move forward with these research on these ideas and solving these puzzles and translating mythology into cybernetics. And I'm not censored much, but especially well-known scholars are very heavily censored. They are completely restricted from going down this path at all. And so they're relying on me. So I have to assume that there are a huge number of followers who are very much depending on my work here. And so I do need help. I've been graced with like Max Freakout giving podcast attention to my work in 2007. And so I could say that's enough. I've posted everything online with date timestamps, so you can see the full detailed history of my development of these decodings and translations between mythology and cybernetics. So this is a good time to to do this podcast and just kind of say, hey, this is really the potent, efficient model that everyone should know it. Whether you agree with it or not, doesn't matter. But everybody really in all these 100 fields would tremendously benefit from knowing this. And at this point, there's my main article, which needs to be updated on my website. Change the word determinism to eternalism, which is much more intense than the idea of determinism, and add the snake versus tree mythology metaphor. But the main article there is quite popular, huge number of hits. So it's definitely making its way out there, and it's a good time.
Yeah,
I want to just say.
Yeah, that the article he's talking about is at egodeath.com, the entheogen theory of religion. And we only have five or six minutes left. And I wanted to sort of tag it with the engineering angle. I mean, it was really one of the things I came away with from this conversation was the sort of engineering mindset that is also in the way you just talk about control and you talk about systems, talk about cybernetics in the description. It was clearly very, it draws from your own experience studying these things, working in engineering, working with computers, et cetera, et cetera. How more recently, I don't know whether you continue to work in engineering or work with computers and networks, da da da, how your own sort of sense of what's happening with computers and with the explosion of engineering in our daily life, how that continues to inform your views, your religious, your larger religious views. Are you still kind of working in that cybernetic framework in some ways?
Well, during the 80s and 90s, I worked on the cybernetic core theory, that kind of approach without mythology. But during the 90s, I did a lot of work on lyrics on rock, metal, acid influenced lyrics, describing the eternalism experience, including non-duality and personal non-control and mono-possibility. So before I got into doing a religious metaphor translation into cybernetics, the transitional phase was deciphering or decoding rock lyrics to identify those lyrics which describe this altered state experience. Then I got heavily ever since the 2000 to 2016, I've been really focused on translating between religious mythology as analogy for cybernetic eternalism. Now I've finished that. I've done more than enough of showing how to do this decoding and encoding between mythology metaphor versus cybernetic eternalism. And at this point, it's just a matter of summarizing, like making a Jack Chick tract to pass out at raves, summarizing the theory efficiently.
I love that. I love that vision. Have you sketched that out?
Not yet. Now, it was so challenging from 1988 to 2006. It was just the struggle. Until until my summary in 1997. So that period was very, very difficult to figure out how to summarize this. There's many ways, and they tended to explode, like because it's a tiny core theory that applies to 100 different fields. How do you rein in that and compact it down? So that's a matter of information design, which is a special interest of mine. How do you efficiently convey this information that enlightenment is a matter of switching from the possibilism model to the eternalism model in the altered state. But it definitely can be done. I've proved it with the main article. It's only like 16 pages long and covers pretty much everything you need to know. So I just need to continue playing around with different comics ways of summarizing the ideas in ways that really have hooks that bring in people, that make it very welcoming to be at a rock arena concert and flip through a little booklet in a very casual way. It can certainly be done. So that's kind of where I'm at.
It's kind of interesting to think about. Again, we just have two minutes or so, but how much even electronic music in general sort of predisposes people to being able to see some of this, since you're working with these loops and processes that are programmed rather than like, the the wild improvisatory soloing of Jerry Garcia or Carlos Santana or whatever, that there's something already about the kind of balance of program and pleasure and giving in to the beat and all of that, that in a way set people up for seeing the world in the ways that you're talking about in terms of these higher loops and the kind of mind melds that people get into on the dance floor.
I don't know if they could incorporate lyrics into electronic music more, but I think that if you're an artist fully informed by my theory, you could work it in various ways into either lyrics in the music or song titles imagery that are informed by. Like, for example, I don't think that Alex Gray is very much informed by my ideas on monopossibility and the snake-shaped frozen future yet.
Yeah, I wouldn't be able to say that. But have you thought about doing a book? Are you going to do that kind of thing? Are you going to take this to another manifestation?
Part of me wants to be a contrarian and an outsider and say, you know, if you want to cite my work, you're going to have to go onto the web because the web rocks. And books are all sort of like the Catholic censored system. You're only allowed to publish this and that. And books I kind of associate with censorship, though I'm a print head, but I kind of like. Howard Rheingold said that when you post at the well, you are publishing, and so I've tried to get him to support me on that and say, you know, if I have a great website and a little pamphlet, maybe there's what you scholars need. Go ahead and cite that, because I want to move scholarship seriously online into hypertext and electronic format and get away from print, this idea that if it's in print, it's credible, but if it's on the internet, it's not credible. Actually, the truth is the reverse.
Well, we've already told people to go to egodeath.com, and we got to wrap it up now. So, Michael, thanks so much for joining us and expanding mind. This was a real fun chat.
Yeah, good to be able to talk with you.
All right. So, from me to all you out there, keep your minds open.